Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in that original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong and how you can take action right now to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of personal revival aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us, no matter what we find to squabble over. You can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322. Or you can always call us direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, you just contact us at bbsradio.com. This website for our show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly or even extra-humanly possible on the station archives. For information and links from this show, you can go to offthegridstofreedom.blogspot.com or email me. Lots is happening, and lots needs to happen to make freedom a reality for all of us. And my blog site is titled How the Neocon Stole Freedom and is conveniently located at How the Neocon Stole Freedom. This week, the story up just a few hours ago is titled The Enemy Within. The article is about Ed Crane, Cato, and the Howie Rich Cogs that have been carrying out the work of the Crane-Cato customers like Koch Industries for these many years. On recent shows, we've heard from Connie Ruffley from United Republicans of California about the reality of Ronald Reagan. We heard from Jim Capo of the John Birch Society about the attacks on that organization for opposing the war in Vietnam in 1965. We've examined the background of William F. Buckley, Jr. and found out that his father was an oil wildcatter whose wealth was in petroleum. That made Junior a natural for the CIA and then to go after the freedom movement in the 50s and 60s. We've also heard from Jennifer McLeod about the ERA and why, and despite what we are so loudly told, women still do not have their God-given rights thanks to Phyllis Schlafly, another early hire for corporate interests. And tonight, we're going to take a look at the end game of American fascism, the bald attempt to take over local government, and how Americans can take it back from the maw of corporate greed. That was a multi-phased operation. The end game has included Cato and the Howie Cogs used in stealth operations to manipulate local governance using an initiative process intended to balance out the inequality of a system that was, even at the turn of the 20th century, heavily weighted to corporations. Taking back control to the local level is what Ron Paul is running for. His charge as president will be to pull back the Fed so that this can move forward. But we need to begin now, and we need to ensure that transparency is the name of the game. The Ron Paul revolution is just that. A revolution that means a new beginning for Americans. Ron Paul is an honest, straightforward man, very unlike those associated with Cato. The Ron Paul campaign is about getting local communities out of the grasp of federal control. Ironically, it was just yesterday that the Browns, IRS resistors in New Hampshire, were arrested by agents that the local sheriff could have told to get out. Sheriff Richard Mack, one of the proponents for the Mack-Prince decision that in 1997 affirmed the sheriff of a county as having standing to order the feds out, has taken up the work of educating sheriffs across the country. That is an essential in the campaign for renewing local. Ron Paul activists know that they, in parallel with their Paul campaign work, need to provide local solutions in their own community. A lack of transparency and control from grid corporations only makes that more difficult. Understanding how corporate money has worked to corrupt the Constitution, the rights of individuals, and erase the borders between federal control and local government that should be in the hands of the people needs to continue. The enemy you face is all too often someone you thought you could trust. This week we learned that the Ron Paul campaign has raised over $5 million for the third quarter of the year, And that came not from big donors, corporations, but from 127,000 small donors. Now that's a real movement. Now just a couple thoughts for the week ahead. The idea behind the spiritual politician is to bring our use of government as a tool for carrying out our civic lives into alignment with our spiritual natures. Therefore, local person-to-person action is what is needed. Most Americans are Christians, but all people from all spiritual traditions understand the same core truth. Love one another. Do the right thing. Do not use lies, manipulation, or violence to achieve your ends, personal, business, or political. We're not there yet, but that's the point on the horizon we as Americans need to hold in our minds and hearts. One of the things we need along the way is a justice system that says a loud no to doing the wrong thing and a yes to the right thing. Our rights are not given to us by government. They come into life with us. So how we take the very abusive and corrupt justice system that is now grinding the lives of Americans into hamburger and change it so that it is a tool that empowers the spiritual vision that is the essence of what America stands for. Now, that's a question. The way we do it is we do it ourselves using persuasion, consent, and the unvarnished truth. Our guest tonight is Richard Mack. Richard Mack was a sheriff in Arizona when he filed a lawsuit, though, that was eventually heard by the Supreme Court. The rest, as they say, is history, and that is literally true in this case. Please welcome Richard Mack. Richard, are you there?
Yes, I could hear your crowd in the background going wild.
Oh, yes. Isn't that exciting? Don't you just love radio that way? That's what makes it such an intimate experience,
yes,
too.
Well, I'm really happy to be with you, and thanks for having me.
Well, it's really my pleasure. I mean, the more I read about just how impactful what you did is going to be on, you know, the years to come, you know, the more you impress me.
Well, thanks. It wasn't as easy as it looked, and it was truly a miracle. I mean, you talk about the spiritual nature of what we're doing today. It really was a miracle. There's just no other way to label winning at the United States Supreme Court, winning against the Clinton administration, winning against the odds that we went against. It was just a truly awe-inspiring experience for this small-town sheriff, and I really felt like this was fate, and I was being led to do this. And then when it actually won at the Supreme Court, it was beyond my wildest dreams. What we expected was a very token decision, and we've got and we received really the most powerful Tenth Amendment decision, perhaps in the history of our country,
mm-hmm.
and certainly within the past few decades. It's extremely powerful. It tells the feds that they don't have the power to do everything they're doing today. But if we can wake people up to that fact, then maybe Congress will discontinue violating this decision almost on a weekly basis.
Mm-hmm. And it's come to that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When you look at and you see what's happening, it's just mind-boggling because they seem to have no sense about whether or not there ever was a Constitution.
Well, that's for sure. That's something I said in 1994 when I first filed the lawsuit, that Congress perpetually violates the constitutional oath that they have all taken. Instead of being the ones to uphold and defend the Constitution, they are the ones destroying it. And I've said numerous times that the greatest enemy to our Constitution is our own federal government.
Mm-hmm, and that's exactly true. And there are ways that we can change that. We can turn that around. And,
well, of course we can.
And one of the things that we can do is we don't actually have to go through them at all.
No.
You had, as the sheriff, and now that's been affirmed, the right to tell them to get out.
Right.
Just get out.
Right.
And that's something that could have made a huge difference in a lot of specific circumstances that people have faced, like
Waco, Randy Weaver.
Yes.
You know, it goes on and on. There's been lots of other incidences where sheriffs should have been involved in protecting their citizens from the abuse and tyranny of the federal government.
That's right. And that's one of the things that we should talk about, because they could have done that, and they had an oath and an obligation to do that. And that's one of the things that you've sort of taken up, and that is informing sheriffs across the country why that isn't just, you know, maybe an option, but what they have to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is, and it's something that my wife and I have been discussing, and we've decided that we want to start our own campaign and make it a family business to where we are traveling the country doing these seminars for sheriffs and sheriff's departments, sheriff candidates, and citizens, so that we can answer once and for all the question, does the sheriff have the authority to stand against the interventions and corruption of the federal government?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the answer is that you do. I mean,
well,
take a look at this.
The bottom line is,
says that.
Yeah, the bottom line is, yes, absolutely, but we're going to give proof positive that that is the case.
Mm-hmm.
And in these seminars, I want to just, again, reiterate, we will take it across the country. We will show the documentation. We will show the copy of our decision at the Supreme Court. You can have it in your hand after I leave your area. You will have these items in your hand so that you can take it to your sheriff, or have us come in and teach your sheriff, or have us teach the entire community. What I prefer doing, I've done these in the past, what I prefer doing is doing the citizens, the concerned citizens, at one seminar, and then the sheriff's office or police employees or sheriff employees at another,
mm-hmm.
and not to commingle the two.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can see there'd be a lot of reasons for not doing that. I mean, there's probably going to be a certain amount of tension there, since people want to be protected, and, of course, the police often want to just go along to get along.
Right, exactly. And I don't want there to be any hesitation on the part of the sheriff's offices to play politics with voters present.
Mm-hmm. And there's so many issues facing Americans today. I mean, there's the real ID, there's the North American Union, there's the Patriot Act,
right.
Suspension of habeas corpus, and the militarization of the police.
Right.
And those are all things that a truly alive and aware sheriff in the county could make a huge difference on.
Well, and let's talk about our favorite whipping post. Look at the IRS.
Oh, boy, yes.
I mean, will your sheriff stand against criminals in this country? And that, yes, I'm talking about the IRS. Now, in 1998, Congress held hearings about the criminality occurring within the IRS. And IRS employees, some of them were still working for the IRS at the time, testified before Congress that the IRS was committing all sorts of crimes. And so, you know, we have to understand, if that's the case, then is the sheriff going to do anything about that?
Mm-hmm.
Or is he just going to allow unfettered access and put his boots up on his desk, lean back in his easy chair and say, boy, you know, it's too bad we have those types of things going on in this county, but I'm going to protect my citizens from drug dealers and ex-cons and pedophiles. But when it comes to having their homes confiscated illegally, improperly from government, they're going to sit back and watch.
Mm-hmm.
The most important possession, physical possession of any citizen, is their home. And yet we lose about 1,000 a week to the IRS.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it is.
It's just amazing that they would be able to get away with doing that.
So even if that was legal, and if there was some lawful authorization for the IRS to do such a thing, that's not what America was about.
Absolutely not.
For government confiscating a home just because you didn't pay a supposed tax bill, and then we kick these people out on the streets, and I have a friend that this happened to. Literally, he lost 40 acres, his farm, home, everything, and his family and kids are literally looking up at him while they march out to the streets with suitcases and bag and what they had on their backs. And yet he's one of the most righteous and wonderful, most honest person I've ever met. And he kind of did the same thing, and then he started studying what the IRS did to him and looked it up, and found out that they had acted inappropriately. But the question remains, after the IRS has a hearing before the United States Congress, and employees of the IRS testify that they fabricate evidence, they fabricate cases against people, especially people who cannot afford a lawyer to defend themselves with. And after all this is testified before Congress, Congress literally did nothing. Well, I don't want to say they did nothing. They said that the IRS would have to be more user-friendly and open offices on Saturday. Yeah, I know. That was the joke that your Congress came up with. And that's
not
how they
Congress.
Took charge. Yeah, I know, exactly. Not mine either. And so the bottom line question I want to ask at these seminars, and the question will be answered, will your county commission, will the individual commissioners stand against tyranny? Will your county sheriff, will your county attorney, will they stand against tyranny? And the bottom line, even if the sheriff has to go it alone, will you, Sheriff Smith, will you stand against tyranny?
Mm-hmm.
Now, give me, go ahead, Melinda, you give me his possible answers.
Yes, of course they will.
Okay, he says yes. If he says yes, then he's on your side and you have him, and then you ask him, great, if you will do that, can we pay to have Sheriff Matt come in with his wife and show you proof positive in a training seminar for you and your deputies how you can do that and give you documentation as to what authority you have in standing against tyranny. Then if he says no to that, then his first answer was a lie.
Well, yes.
Now, if he says no, some of your sheriffs will say no.
Well,
okay.
That's pretty shocking.
I won't stand against tyranny, and he'll tell you a bunch of reasons. Now, his reasons will be, first of all, it's not his jurisdiction. It's not his job to stand against the federal government. We will show him proof positive that it is.
And that actually right there brings up an interesting issue, because he signed an oath to preserve and protect the Constitution.
Correct.
And what that means is he would be violating his oath by refusing to do that.
Oh, of course.
And
yes.
In that case, yeah, that would be an offense that certainly should, you know, move the citizenry to take action against him and call for his recall or removal.
Well, of course. I mean, again, and we said this before at the beginning of this subject, what more could your sheriff do that would be more valuable?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I mean, you know, write more tickets, you know, kick in more doors, make more arrests. You know, we're talking about the preservation of liberty here and preserving the principles upon which this country was founded.
Absolutely.
And if your sheriff's not going to do that, then what else could he do that would really matter?
Nothing.
Yeah. I mean, every sheriff in there, I mean, 98% of your sheriffs are still going to investigate crime, you know, in some of their good old boy situations, which we have here, regrettably. But a lot of places have a sheriff that knows everybody, and he takes care of certain individuals. That's going to happen. But for the most part, your sheriff is going to investigate crime. If a murder occurs, he's going to investigate. He's going to do whatever he can to keep drugs out of the community, although that's another subject, but that's an exercise in futility. But they're still going to do whatever they can to make it a safe place to live, because they know they're not going to get elected if they don't try to do that, re-elected if they don't try to do those things.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody's going to do that. Where the rubber hits the pavement is if your sheriff has the guts to stand against the encroachments of the federal government. And therein lies the true value of a sheriff.
Yes, absolutely. If they don't have the willingness to do that, they really shouldn't be sheriff.
No, they shouldn't. And it's just a token job. if they're not going to do that sort of thing.
So what you're really saying here is that your job is to help citizens identify whether or not the person who's in that office should remain there.
True. Yeah, that's it. And there's some sheriffs, I give you this, this is well known, that most of the sheriffs get in there not knowing what their full authority and job is.
Mm-hmm.
We
so
will
they
teach
could just
them,
be ignorant.
Yeah, of course. And that's going to happen because, I mean, look at what our system has done. Look at what the dumbing down of our educational system has done and the media control and the influence of television. And these sheriffs, to really know their job, would have to be doing a lot of studying and review of history and really delve into the history of the sheriff and the constitutional authority that he has.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them don't do that because what do? We go along. Most people just go along. We're creatures of habit. And so I grant you that there might be some really good people in the sheriff's offices in this country and perhaps some other offices in the counties as well that are good people that just are a little bit ignorant about really what their job is all about.
Mm-hmm.
We will teach you in these seminars what the job of the sheriff is. And not from any extremist view. This will be documentation of the court case that I filed and the history of the sheriff and the appropriate adherence to what you mentioned earlier, the oath of office that your sheriff takes.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk about police ethics. We'll talk about the oath of office. We'll talk about the Supreme Court decision on my case. We'll talk about the history of the sheriffs. And we'll train them what their job is when it comes to what the Declaration of Independence said, that it is the people's duty and right to abolish abusive government
mm-hmm.
and to establish new guards.
That's right, for our future security.
Exactly. And so all of this is just basic, fundamental American idealism. And so we're going to teach that, and then after we teach it and your sheriff still refuses to come on board, then you've got some work to do to get a new sheriff.
That's right. And I'm sure there are going to be a lot of new sheriffs in the sort of sheriff fold, right?
Right, right.
Because that needs to happen. Now, you went through a process with this yourself,
yes.
figuring out what you were going to need to do and confronting the fact that you had to adhere to the Constitution and the oath that you'd signed.
Sure.
And why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because that's, I think, an amazing story.
Well, I was a rookie police officer, and I started my police career in Provo, Utah, and I worked for the Provo Police Department. And I had just finished an undercover assignment, and I spent about 8 or 9 months totally undercover, working narcotics. I could very rarely be with my own family. I had a wife and 3 children, 3 small children at the time. And I couldn't be seen in public with them at all. I could not go to the police station. I got my pay in the mail, and or was it maybe it was direct deposit? I don't know. But anyway, I had a liaison with one of the police officers from the department who I would meet and turn over evidence to, and I'd meet him somewhere at night at a church or somewhere else that was secluded. And other than that, I had no contact at the police department where I had already worked about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so after this assignment, I'd returned to patrol for a short time, and then after that, I was promoted to a school resource officer, and I did a lot of work inside the school district of Provo and trying to get the community to address the drug problem that they had there. So one day I was writing a bunch of tickets, and I was really a by the numbers officer. I wrote a lot of tickets. I did exactly what my sergeant told me. The police department there and almost all police departments nationwide want a lot of numbers. This
mm-hmm.
is they want tickets, they want arrests, they want shoplifters arrested, they want to be able to prove to the city council that we're out there and that we're busy and that we need more officers because we're out there so busy.
Mm-hmm. And what they're trying to do is a lot of the things that you're doing are really generating income for them.
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah, the revenue coming in on speeding tickets alone. Speeding tickets, just speeding tickets in this country brings in about $6 billion a year.
$6 billion in speeding tickets.
Yes.
People should think about that.
And so if you wonder why these photo radar operations are coming across the country, it's simply because of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's big, big money.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean big money. And city councils and county commissions love that money. So anyway, one day I'm out writing tickets, and it was a beautiful fall day. And Utah can really be beautiful that time of year. And I'm right next to a school. I'm at about 600 West and 300 South in Provo, and I was just filling out my daily activity report, catching up on the numbers that I had already garnered for the day, and I'm facing north, just south of a four-way stop intersection, again, right next to an elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
And I look up, and I see this lady in an old beat-up Datsun compact station wagon run through the stop sign. And she's fighting with, like, three or four kids in the car, and she looks over and sees that she went through the stop sign, and she looks over at me, and she throws her hands up in the air like, oh, good heavens, what else could go wrong today?
Mm-hmm.
And so she immediately pulls over. I didn't even have to turn on my red and blue lights. And I walk up to her and ask her for her license and registration. And she already has them ready for me, and she just kind of hands them out the window and keeps staring right through her steering wheel through the front window of her car. And her kids are still fighting, and she's acting like she doesn't care anymore. She's not yelling at the kids. One or two of them are crying. The other one's fighting and hitting, and they're not dressed very well, and they're, you know, kind of snotty-nosed kids, and she's driving a car that was maybe worth $500, and
mm-hmm.
there was gray primer showing through the kind of tan colored paint on the car, and
well, she really can't afford a ticket.
Oh no, not at all. No, it was obvious she couldn't afford the ticket, and I just started writing the ticket, and I really said to myself, man, this is going to be easy, and because she's not even putting up a fuss or anything, and I already knew what happened. I knew that she did not go through the stop sign on purpose. I knew that she was having a horrible time with her kids, and that they caused her not to see the stop sign, and she went through it. And there was nobody else around, just me. I was the closest one to the intersection. I was like about 75 feet from the intersection. So she endangered no one. And normally, you know, you could easily say, you know, ma'am, if you're having a bad day, you probably ought to pull over and get your kids situated and then, you know, maybe go home or wherever you were going. Maybe you ought to wait until your kids get situated and then drive. I could have done that and just told her I had a better day and went on with my business. But I just started writing the ticket merrily on with my job, and this was going to be another slash mark for my ticket amount for that day, which I was hoping to get about 15 to 20 tickets that day and get an attaboy from my sergeant, a pat on the back. And anyway, when I finished filling out the ticket, right when I came to sign my name and put my serial number on the ticket, I started slowing down. And I paused for a moment, and I looked down at this lady's kids, and she was about 35 going on 70.
Yes.
And I looked down at her and her kids, and I looked at her dilapidated old crappy car, and then, Melinda, I looked at me. And it was the most penetrating, profound view of myself that I had ever felt. And I was so ashamed of what I was doing. And I asked myself, Mac, is there anything that you're doing here that's right? Is there anything that you're doing here that's bringing honor to your badge? And is there anything you're doing here that's making Provo a better place to live?
Mm-hmm.
And after I answered those questions to myself, I felt lower than a worm next to a gutter. And I felt like I had to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
I felt ashamed. I felt that I couldn't look myself in the face or ever garner the respect of anybody ever again. And I mean, I felt low.
Preserve and protect.
Exactly, and that crossed my mind too. And so who are you protecting and who are you serving right at this time of giving this lady a ticket that she cannot afford? And I didn't say anything to her. I just took the ticket and walked back to my car and drove back to the police station. And the police station was only like 3.5 blocks from there. So I went right to the police station, tore that ticket up, which is against the rules, may have even been against the law, but it was against the rules to do that. And all the tickets were accounted for, but I guess my sergeant or lieutenant didn't happen to check this batch that I got out that day.
Uh-huh.
And I tore the ticket up into 100 pieces and threw them in the trash can. And then I just kind of worked the rest of my shift. It was a swing shift. I got off at 10:30 that night. And I didn't write any more tickets, and I just kind of wondered who I was the rest of the night. And the next day, before I came back to work, I went into the city clerk's office and asked her for a copy of my oath of office. And I had signed it, and it was dated. And it said that I, Richard Mack, swear and affirm to uphold and defend the United States Constitution and to protect and obey and defend the same against all enemies. So help me God. And so I said, right then, I felt even worse. I said, what a hypocrite. You've never even read the Constitution, and you swore an oath in God's name that you would uphold and defend and obey the United States Constitution. And the oath in Utah just does say obey.
Uh-huh.
So how am I going to obey the United States Constitution? I never even read it. And so right then, I was about ready to go turn my badge in and quit the job. And I said, well, listen, Mac, you're no quitter. You've never been a quitter. You don't have to quit your job. You just have to quit being a hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
So I went home and got the World Book Encyclopedia and opened it up to the Constitution. And I kept that with me the rest of the night, and I read it over and over. I probably read the Constitution, especially the Bill of Rights, about 3 or 4 times that night.
Mm-hmm.
While I was working as a police officer, at that point, I made a promise to myself that I would never be on the wrong side again.
Uh-huh. And that's an oath you've kept.
Yes.
So then you went to Arizona.
And then, no, I still stayed there. I was there about another 3 years after that. And then I moved home to Arizona in 1998 to run for sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
And that incident, I would say that incident occurred to me in like probably the fall of 1983. And because in 1984 I took the job at the school, with the school district. I was still working for Provo PD, but I was assigned to this Provo school district as the school resource officer. So yeah, about 4 years later I ran for sheriff. And I continued my studies, and I studied under Cleon Skousen. I went to one of his seminars, and in 1995, when I was elected sheriff, I did another training seminar, and I went to the movie called Braveheart.
Oh, yes. Great movie.
It's a documentary of freedom.
That's right. Absolutely.
You know, it's probably the best movie I've ever seen, and it's a great lead-in to show people part of that, and I will do part of that for the training course that I do, because it's so profound and poignant when it comes to the issues of freedom.
Absolutely.
And so Robert the Bruce was arguing with his father about going along with political correctness or standing for freedom, he finally told his father that he would be on William Wallace's side. And he said, because when I looked in his eye, I could tell that all he wanted was freedom.
Yes.
that he wasn't doing it for glory. He wasn't doing it for land or title or riches. He was just doing it because he wanted freedom. And so he looked his father in the eye, and he had tears rolling down his cheeks, and he said, "I will never be on the wrong side again." And that hit me so powerfully because it was the exact same words that I had promised myself back in 1983 or 84, whatever it was, 83, when I stopped that lady on that ticket. So I...
Did you ever want to thank her?
Oh, yes, I really would. I wish I could see her today. I had to put an ad in the Provo paper and ask her, you know, because I often wonder, what in the world did she think I was doing? You know, when I drove off, she thought, I wonder how long she waited there to see if I was going to come back and give her the ticket.
That's a good question.
You know? But I never, I never looked back at her. I never said anything. I didn't tell her, well, ma'am, you know, put my thumbs in my, under my belt, in front of my waist, you know, and put my thumbs there and kind of act like a big shot cop. Buck Savage is the cop that we all trained under, who always was acting like a big shot.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't act like Buck Savage and say, ma'am, this is your lucky day. I'm going to cut you some slack. Because if she had thanked me for something, I probably would have just died right there on the spot of shame. I didn't want her to thank me because I deserve no thanks whatsoever. I didn't want her to go, oh, bless you, officer, you know, because I can't afford this. And I wasn't going to take that money away from that lady and those kids. No way, no how. And I didn't want to be thanked for doing something that I was doing because I was on the wrong side and I was doing the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, but I have thought about her a lot. And I never saw her again. And I guess by the time that I realized and woke up and converted myself to the Constitution, by that time, you know, I didn't make any effort to try to go find her. But...
That's an interesting phrase you just used.
Which one?
Converted to the Constitution.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've used that a lot.
That's a great phrase.
And it really is a conversion process.
Uh-huh. It is, because you can see that people, they start out not understanding until they take a look at it and they sort of, you know, have that survey of their own souls and understand why what they're doing is wrong.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the process, and what I want, and... Like I say, it's my wife and me that want to start this and do this as a family business because we want to convert people. And, you know, we really can't convert people, but we can give them the information where they can convert themselves.
Yes.
And so all we are is a tool in the process, but the information and the truth has to be out there. And so that's what we're going to do as part of this. I want to say ministry, but it's not a ministry. It's an educational process. It's a freedom movement.
Yes.
And I still don't have the name of the business or the name of the seminar, but it's got to be something near or close to the responsibility of the sheriff.
Uh-huh.
Or the proper role of the sheriff.
The freedom sheriff.
The freedom sheriff or the constitutional sheriff.
Yes, the constitutional sheriff. I like that, the constitutional sheriff, because that's really what you're talking about here. You're talking about a sheriff who understands that their first duty is to affirm the Constitution and all that it means to people at the most local level.
Right.
Because that's where we live.
Right. And so that's what I intend to do. If we can... raise the money and get some grants. There's some grants out there. My wife will be the owner and president of the company, and I'll be the, you know, her vice president or general manager or whatever, because we really do want to do this together. And she's been at some of these seminars with me that I've done in the past across the country. She's very good help, and she knows what's going on. And quite frankly, also, if I'm traveling, I'd rather her be with me.
Well, I could understand that. I mean, you're married.
Yeah. And like,
and then,
for instance,
you know what to do because she tells you.
Well, exactly, and she keeps things organized, and I know that my number one confidant and boss are going to be there to help me out.
Amen. That's
so,
a great thing.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to do. I mean, it's telling people what sheriffs are going to have to do. It's sort of reaffirming the people in the fact that they're really the ones in charge, and a lot of them think that they're not anymore. And it's having them understand the inappropriate role taken by government in a lot of these things, like the Real ID, I mean, and the Patriot Act and the suspension of habeas corpus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and the militarization of the police, which I know is something that's concerning more people every day.
Yeah, and is your sheriff going to be concerned with that, or is he just going to go along? And
mm-hmm.
if you want him to be properly educated, then let's get him educated.
Absolutely. And, you know, like just in the last few days, the things that you've seen local police do, I mean, there was a woman who was killed at the Phoenix airport. There was the woman that was in the wheelchair that was tasered to death. There was the boy that was, you know, the student who was confronting Carrie and asked a question about skull and bones and ended up being tasered. As Carrie just stands there and goes, well, I mean, maybe he shouldn't have asked that question.
Hmm? Freedom-loving Carrie, yes.
That's right.
Well, you know, and really, Carrie really had an opportunity to show some real leadership at that point. You know, he could have said to officers, we might not agree with what he's doing or with what he's saying, but I will respectfully request that you respect his right to be stupid or right to be wrong. And Carrie would have come out of there like a hero and a half.
Well, he would have, but it's interesting.
Especially if he had stopped
it.
If he had even gone down there while they were tasering him, and if he had stopped the police from tasering him, Carrie would have, oh my gosh, they would have, you know, all sides would have flocked to him.
That's true. They would have.
Left and right would have flocked to him.
But he didn't do that. And it was obvious that it wouldn't even have occurred to him to do that.
Right. Well, he's too mainstream and he's too politically correct.
He's too corporate.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take a look at, that's exactly where he's coming from. He's definitely a corporate. And really, you can take a look at most of them in just that way. If they're aligned with the corporate agenda, then they act one way. And then you have the very few people who are like Ron Paul who act in a very different way.
Yeah, man. I'll tell you what. If Ron Paul could just get into office, I mean, here again, that would be another miracle. But I believe in miracles.
Well, so do I.
And he's already making huge headway into doing lots better than I ever thought he would be. And I think if we would get behind him, we might just get another miracle on this country.
We could. I mean, you look at it and you think, God, did you have this lined up for us? Was this your intention? Thank you very much. If that's the case, it sure looks like it.
Yep.
And that would be a really wonderful thing.
Yep.
And you've talked a little bit about what you're going to do about this, and of course there's going to be a rule for Americans simply taking back their counties, so that there's, again, they're looking at the sheriff as being the one that works for them, the police as being people who work for them to protect and serve.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that gives us an opportunity to take a look into the past in that relationship that we all used to have with the police when we had kids who were told, well, you know, the policeman's there to help you, and nobody even snickered, because we all believed that that was absolutely the truth. And I think you and I both grew up in that period of time when that was still true about America, that he was there to help us and we could trust the police. And I think it's interesting that left and right, that was really into the 50s, into the 60s, we believed that we could trust the police.
Yes, and we believed that we were going to Vietnam for an honorable reason.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, boy, the more you study and look back at things, these myths just fall apart in front of your face, don't they?
They do. They fall apart, and you go, well, wait a minute. That's not what we thought. It's different. And all of those things, I think that one of the interesting things that's now coming about is that we're realizing that we were lied to.
Mm-hmm.
We were lied to consistently with sort of malice, or at least with an agenda for a long period of time,
right.
And that what we're realizing, and you're seeing this, you know, in the political landscape, with people on the left and right looking at each other and something dawning on their faces, wait a minute, you're not the problem. that you're not the problem at all. It's them that's the problem. And I think that that's, you know, along with everything else, I think that there's sort of an amazing potential that's waking up for Americans now, that they can view each other differently, mm-hmm. that they can see the commonality. And as you're going out and working in counties, I suspect that one of the things that you're going to find is that you have a lot of people on the left who are right there, and they're ready and eager to help and listen.
Well, I do too, and I again come back to the one thing that this all boils down to, and that is one, following the founding fathers, following the plan that they set out for us, follow the Constitution, stay within its perimeters, and one other thing, Ben Franklin warned that if we refuse to learn from history, we are doomed to repeat it, and if you look back at the war in Vietnam and then Bush's empty promise that we're going to go to Iraq, but we're not going to make it another Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
Sure enough, here we are 5 years later and $500 billion and over 3,000 American lives. We're headed right smack dab into what? Worse than Vietnam.
Much worse than Vietnam. And I think they're over 1 million Iraqis have been killed, and there's 4 million of them who have had to refugee out and are now homeless.
Well, but what are we doing? We're freeing the Iraqi people. We're liberating the Iraqi people.
From their oil. See, they just didn't finish the sentence. We're freeing them from their oil.
Yeah. Well.
That's really what's going on there. And I think you and I have both been Republicans. You were a registered Republican, right?
I was once.
And, you know, I still am now.
Yeah.
Because, of course, that's the only way that I can support Ron Paul.
Yes.
But, you know, my vision of what the Republican Party is has changed so much. And there are a lot of things that, and when I look at it, that I'd really like to say to Republicans so that they understand that this isn't about, you know, being angry with them. They were taken advantage of, too. This is a matter of, again, us coming together and really defining what the mission for the Republican Party was.
Right.
Because there was a time, you know, when I was very proud to be a Republican. I was proud that the idea that that was the party that stood for, you know, universal human freedom.
Yeah.
And it was going to absolutely uphold my constitutional rights. And it was going to always be right out there in the forefront telling me the truth. And I believed that.
Yes. Yeah, so did I. And it pains me to say it. I actually believed in a lot of the things that Ronald Reagan said, and I believed he was going to make government smaller and abolish the Department of Education and then maybe even go into some other departments as well. But
yeah, that's what I thought.
He never did. And
I have to tell you, finding out that you know, what he had actually done in California, my dad actually had been unhappy that he had instituted the withholding tax in California. But when Connie Roughly gave me those three sheets of paper in 8-point type that had all the different things that he had done, and I looked, I had to sit down. I was standing up when I opened it, and it was in my mail. And then I looked at it, and I said, wait a minute, I got to sit down now.
Yeah.
Because it was, I had this vision of Ronnie, because he used to call and talk to my dad.
Wow.
And I have to tell you, that was one of those moments that you just don't want to have to go through. And I think that all of us have been through a lot of moments like that, finding out the people we thought we could trust, really, we couldn't trust. And it was tragic.
Yeah.
Because it's disrupted relationships, and it's made us view each other with suspicion. And that's really not the way we want the world to be, either, is it? And was there a moment for you like that with Ronnie?
Yeah. It may have been a little bit more gradual, but yeah, I think so.
Mhm. Yeah, I think a lot of us believed that he went into office as president, and he really, really meant what he said, and he was going to go, and he was going to to roll it back, and then it was because of the assassination attempt, and we tried to blame
Bush. To rationalize
Bush.
It for that, yeah.
We were going to blame Bush Sr. It was his fault, and it was never anything Ronnie wanted or did. And then you find out things like what the Iraq resolution, and you just can't look at it the same way.
Yeah.
But, you know, no matter what else he did, I have to say that Ronnie was... He was really a wonderful guy. I mean, if you know him personally.
Yeah, I don't know what happened necessarily. I thought he was a good man, and I still believe he was a good man. But he sure didn't. He sure just didn't do what he said he was going to do.
Amen. He sure didn't do that.
Know, he lowered taxes, and other than that, government grew bigger and. You know, our meddling in foreign affairs grew stronger. And
mm-hmm. And one of the things I think that is the things that that you're going to do from everything you said is that you're really going to take that Constitution and put it into the hands of every American, right?
Yes.
So that they can read it and they can understand what their government is about and what the rules are. It's like you're going to play a game of Monopoly. Here's the rules.
Right.
And that sounds like it's going to be a really great thing. So you and your wife are going to start reaching out to Americans with the Constitution, explaining how the Constitution works,
mm-hmm.
and explaining what the responsibility is for each sheriff and each elected official in their own county.
And responsibility of the citizen to make
mm-hmm.
sure that they're being vigilant as well. Thomas Jefferson said the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. And or was that Patrick Henry? Anyway, he's one of the founding fathers. And we as citizens need to be involved in making sure that our public officials and our public servants are just doing exactly what their oath requires them to do. So it's our responsibility as well. It's not just the sheriff's responsibility, and he needs the backing of his constituents and the citizens in his county. And so we're going to address all those topics. But the main one is the sheriff needs the truth, needs information, needs the tools that he can do his job with and take these stands and stand against tyranny and for liberty and freedom. And we can start getting our country back county by county and state by state.
That's going to be a wonderful thing. Could you tell people how to get in touch with you?
Well, yeah. Just email me at sheriffmack@hotmail.com.
And we'll have a website up soon, right?
And we need to get our website about this going. And quite frankly, we're going to do fundraising for this, and we're also going to put in for grants. And there's some women organizations out there that do grants to women, so my wife can get some grants to start her new business, and then get people on board across the country. And then people like you and others will need to. Set up seminars in your area and call us and make arrangements to have us come out to your area and we'll do it.
Yeah, and we're going to make it happen. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Sheriff Mack.
Well, I thank you too.
And you God bless. And, you know, I hope that both God and the Constitution go with you.
Well, thanks. And I'm going to take them with me wherever I go.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
You take care.
Bye-bye, Melinda.
Bye. And that's our show for today, Friday, October 5th, 2007. All we need is the truth. Without that, we can't prepare to meet what's coming, survive, and build a new and better world for our children. There's a constant message, if we listen, that says to each of us, I love you. We're connected, one in the sacred. When you're frightened, remember, you're never really alone. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. This remains where we want to go today. It's up to each of us to reach the destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.